Chapter 2, The Invasion of Spindrift. Hartzenbrandt reacted first. He said severely, "I've tried to teach Rick that one never points a firearm at people. You're setting a bad example for him." Then the scientist smiled and held out his hand. "This is an unexpected pleasure, Steve. Why didn't you let us know you were coming, and why the disguise?" Steve Ames, a chief agent of YANIG, the Joint Army-Navy Intelligence Group with which Spindrift had so often worked, straightened up and grinned. He winked at the astonished young people. "Hi, gang," the trio chorused. "Hi, Steve." Steve shook hands with Hartzenbrandt and explained, "I'm not really setting a bad example. If you look closely, you'll see that the bolt of this chopper is open, the safety is on, and there isn't a round in the chamber."
"But why carry it at all?"
Barbie demanded. Rick closed his mouth. He had been about to ask the same thing. He felt a tingle of excitement. When Steve Ames showed up on Spindrift, adventure wasn't far off. The federal agent came to Spindrift only for help, and then only when his usual sources had failed. The first time he had asked for help, the Spindrifters had worked with Steve in Washington. Recently, quite by accident, the boys had become involved in a YANIG case while vacationing in the Virgin Islands. As that adventure had come to an end, Steve had warned them that he might see them again soon. And now here he was. "The reason for the chopper is a long story," Steve answered Barbie. "But the reason for the uniform is simple. It's mine." It seemed, then, that Steve, who had never before appeared as anything but a civilian, was actually a full commander in the Coast Guard. Rick marveled at how little they really knew about their friend. He certainly excelled at keeping his mouth shut. He was probably a reserve officer.
"I think you look handsome in it,"
Barbie said dreamily. The boys had kidded her before about getting all misty-eyed when Steve showed up. Actually, Steve was a very handsome young man, so Barbie's mild crush was understandable. "Well, that makes it worth wearing, then," Steve said gallantly. Barbie beamed. Hartzenbrandt detached a key from his chain and handed it to Steve with a flourish. "You said you were taking over the island, I believe? You'll need the house key." Rick smiled. That was his father's way of leading the conversation back to Steve's reason for coming, without taking the edge off of their delight at the unexpected reunion. But Steve was not to be pushed into business talk so easily. He looked at Rick. "You and your schemes. I think I'll poke it full of holes just to show you that crime doesn't pay." Scotty asked curiously, "How much did you hear?" "The whole plan. I've been casing the joint, as we like to say." "Okay, Rick. You must have considered that a rash of winners wearing hearing aids would attract attention and comment. How are you going to prevent that?" Rick answered automatically, his mind not really on his great idea anymore. So Steve had been casing the island? He replied, "Not all the hearing aids would be visible. I mean, for example, I could make a receiver for Barbie that would be an ornamental plastic band to wear, the way girls wear barrettes. Or I could fit a receiver into a special pair of glasses. There's one type of hearing aid that's built into glasses, you know."
"I do know. All right, I'll try again then," Steve agreed. "Each contestant that looks good to the program people gets a thorough quizzing on the chosen subject before being accepted. That's to find out if they're really experts. How are you going to handle that?"
Rick hadn't known about that. He pondered a moment.
"Well, that means we'd have to prepare a hidden transmitter too, so we can help out during the examination."
"It could be done. The contestants could wear the gadgets strapped to their legs, under their skirts or their trousers." Steve was enjoying Rick's ready responses. His eyes twinkled.
"You'd have to use a very limited range on your megabuck mob transmitter and a very high frequency. Otherwise, the FCC could pick you up, use a directional finder, and move in on your operation. They might locate you anyway, even on low power and ultra-high frequency. What are you going to do about that?"
Rick held up his hands in surrender.
"I'm not. I can't take a chance of getting the federal government into the act. Wow, I'd have the FCC, the FBI, and maybe a dozen others on my trail. I quit. The Megabuck mob is hereby dissolved."
Rick looked disappointed.
Oh, and I was hoping your plan was foolproof. I was about to buy stock in the mob.
The amusement in his eyes belied the words. Hartson Brandt laughed.
I'm glad you're the one that stuck a pin in his bubble, Steve. The way that Barbie makes cakes, I'm not sure that Rick could ever break one to get a file out.
Steve chuckled. The records are full of foolproof get-rich-quick schemes like this one, and the jails are full of halfway criminal geniuses, too. But don't overlook the advantages of an eat-proof cake. It might come in handy to throw at the guards during the getaway.
The young people laughed. And then Barbie sobered suddenly.
Rick, could you really put one of those things in my hair?
He had an image of the gadget in his mind, and he knew it would work. Sure, sis, why?
It's just an idea I want to talk to you about later.
She turned to Steve and asked anxiously.
You do know that Rick was only fooling, don't you, Steve? He wouldn't steal anything from anybody, honestly.
Steve nodded. Of course, Barbie. I won't throw him in jail this time. I'll probably need him at some point.
Is that what you're here for?
She asked. Actually, I need all of you, Steve said. He motioned to the chairs. Sit down. Can Mrs. Brandt join us?
Hartson Brandt went to go get her while the young people started to deluge Steve with questions. He held up a hand in protest.
Wait until the whole family's here, please.
In a moment, Mrs. Brandt joined them and greeted Steve cordially. Then the young agent got serious.
I was only partly joking when I said I wanted to take over Spindrift. I really do, in a way. Here's why. We've had a team of scientists working on a project that's of the greatest importance to national defense. There are four of them in the team, and they're all top-notch, Hartson. I'm sure you'll know some of them, if not all of them, by reputation.
Steve removed the ammunition clip from his submachine gun and sighted through the barrel, then let the bolt ram home with a sharp click.
It was my job to guard the project. As you know, I had to go to the Virgin Islands, but I left one of my best men in charge, and he did his job thoroughly. I'm satisfied about that. No unknown person had been near the project office, and no unknowns have been in close contact with any of the team. And yet, two of them are in the hospital now.
Sick or wounded? Scotty asked.
Neither, really. We don't know what's wrong. Their minds just suddenly ceased to function.
Hartson Brandt leaned forward.
You mean they're unconscious?
Steve shook his head.
Not in the usual sense. It's as though all their thoughts and memories had suddenly become scrambled. Have you ever seen a teletype machine in operation, particularly one that's suddenly gone haywire?
Rick had. The news machine over at the Whiteside Morning Record did that. It was typing out clear copy, then suddenly there wasn't anything there but gibberish.
That's it, Steve agreed. It's the best analogy I can think of for what's happened to the two scientists. When a teletype goes haywire, one moment everything is clear and perfect, and the next, everything is scrambled. All the letters are there, but they no longer make any sense. The scientists talk words, common everyday words, but the words don't make up thoughts or sentences. They're just sounds strung together.
How awful,
Mrs. Brandt murmured.
Barbie looked horrified.
Rick searched his memory for anything similar he had ever read about or heard of, but there was nothing. From the expressions on their faces, his father and Scotty were equally puzzled.
Well, even though I have absolutely no evidence of foul play, I've decided not to take any chances. I got one of the scientists to go along with my plan. He shares my concern, simply on the basis that no known disease would affect human beings in this way. And two scientists of the same team being struck down at the same time, well, that's just too much coincidence.
He's very wise, Hartson Brandt agreed.
He also has a family. The other scientist is not. He's a crusty old bachelor who thinks the whole thing is nonsense and insists on staying right where he is.
How do we fit in? Scotty asked. You said you needed all of us.
That's right. I want to relocate the project to Spindrift.
Using the cooperative scientist as the basis for a new staff?
Yes. We went through the most complicated maneuvers you ever saw to get him out of Washington with his family. I'm certain his movements can't be traced. So his presence here would be a complete secret.
But it isn't just a scientist. I'm also asking you to take in his family, consisting of his wife and his daughter.
Of course we will,
Mrs. Brandt said warmly. Steve turned to Barbie. I think you'll enjoy it because the girl is just your age, and she's friendly and a pleasant young lady. Barbie looked pleased and excited.
What's her name?
Janice. Janice Miller. Is the scientist Dr. Walter Miller by any chance? Hartson Brandt asked quickly. Exactly right. Do you know him?
Well, not personally. We've never met. But a few years ago, we carried on a very extensive correspondence on the subject of energy levels and nuclear isomers.
Steve grinned. I won't pretend to know what you're talking about, but I'm glad you'll have something in common. Will you and your staff join him to make up a new project team?
I think we can do that, Hartson Brandt said thoughtfully. Some of us can put aside what we're doing. I'll have to know a little more about the project, of course.
The federal agent nodded. Dr. Miller can give you the details personally.
Rick expressed a thought that had been on his mind.
We're sort of isolated here, but we're certainly not cut off from the world. Our friends visit us, and we go to the mainland almost every day. How are we going to explain who these people are? I'm sure you don't want their names to get out.
I'll give you a cover story. Their name is Morrison. You met them through Dr. Ernst while you were in the Virgin Islands. They were very hospitable, and you're simply returning their hospitality. They know the islands well from vacations spent there, so no one is going to trip them up on details.
How about the details of our trip? Scotty asked.
They've been briefed thoroughly by me. You can check them and fill in any missing details.
Barbie giggled. I'm glad you didn't have any doubts about our taking them in, Steve.
Steve knows we're available anytime he needs us and for anything we can give, Rick said. Steve smiled his thanks.
Well, now you can guess why I showed up with a hunk of artillery under my wing. I had to be sure there wasn't a reception committee waiting.
You never can tell about information leaks, no matter how careful you are. So I landed at the back of the island with a squad of men, and we went over the place with a fine-tooth comb. I didn't walk in until I was certain there wasn't a stranger on the island, including strangers you might not have known about.
Hartson Brandt rose. Well, I think we've settled all initial details except where we're going to put the Millers, or rather the Morrisons. Can you bring them tomorrow?
Steve rose, too. As Rick and Barbie said, I didn't have any doubts. How about tonight?
Tonight?
Barbie gasped.
Are they already here?
Almost. They're on a cutter offshore. If it isn't convenient, I can keep them overnight.
Of course it's convenient, Mrs. Brandt said firmly. We'll put Mr. and Mrs. Morrison in John Gordon's room. He's still out west. And we'll take the spare twin bed out of Hobart Zircon's room and put Janice in with Barbie. Bring them ashore right away, Steve. Barbie and I will get busy, and Rick and Scotty can move the spare bed.
Wonderful. Steve walked out to the porch and coughed twice. Rick hurried to his side just in time to see one of the trees in the orchard yield up a dark shadow that turned out to be a Coast Guard petty officer, carbine and ready and walkie-talkie slung over his shoulder.
Let me have your horn, Smitty, Steve requested.
The Coast Guard man gave Rick a curious look as he handed Steve the phone. The agent said,
Nevada, this is Texas. Deliver the goods.
The reply was,
Texas, this is Nevada. The package is in the mail.
Steve handed the phone back to the Coast Guardman and ordered,
Get the boys together and return to the ship, Smitty. Repeat their instructions. They don't know where they've been, and they don't know what they've been doing. Right?
Smitty grinned.
Aye, aye, sir. That won't be hard. None of us really know where we've been or what we've been doing.
Life is always easier that way, Steve said. Now shove off.
Aye, aye, sir.
The guardsmen faded into the night.
Let's move furniture, Steve suggested.
For the next few moments, the house was a flurry of activity. Rick and Scotty dismantled the twin bed in Zircon's room, explaining only to the big scientist that unexpected company had arrived. Zircon, engrossed in a theoretical problem, scarcely even noticed. By the time Mrs. Brandt was satisfied with arrangements and had counted the towels for the third time, Steve called from downstairs that the boat was arriving.
Rick, Scotty, and Barbie ran to Steve's side and walked with him toward the landing where the Spindrift boats were moored. Dismal had paid little attention to the proceedings, but now, fearful of being left behind, the pup raced ahead of the group. The Coast Guard gave Rick a curious look. The boat carrying the Morrisons, for so Rick was already conditioning himself to think of them, was approaching the dock. As the group hurried to meet the unexpected guests, two Coast Guardmen leaped from the big motor whaleboat and made it fast. Dismal got there first. He barked furiously, trying to frighten off the invaders. Then his bark suddenly changed to an anguished howl as a new voice joined in the racket. It was a feline voice, and a highly indignant one.
"Great-grandma's ghost," Steve exclaimed. "I forgot to tell you, they have a cat."
Dismal shot by them, followed by an enormous creature with glowing eyes that yowled at the top of its lungs in what was probably very coarse language to anyone who spoke cat talk. Dismal had at last met his match and was beating an inglorious retreat. Just as Rick was about to take up the chase and rescue his pup, the cat decided to break off the engagement. The ruffled fur subsided slightly as the animal turned from the chase and approached the four who had been hurrying to the pier. In the beam of Steve's flashlight, Rick saw that the cat was a huge blue Persian, and though he knew little about cats, he recognized that this was an aristocrat of its kind. The Persian gave a meow of greeting, then walked up and rubbed against Barbie's legs. It gave out a noise that reminded Rick of a wood rasp rubbing over a piece of broken pine. The cat was purring. Barbie had stamped her foot angrily at the sight of Dismal being forced to retreat to the house, but the cat was too much for her.
"Oh, you beautiful thing!"
she exclaimed, and picked the creature up. It responded by purring even more loudly. Rick grinned. On the pet level, at least, the Morrison invasion was off to a fast start. He hoped that the incident wasn't symbolic.